Children being yanked out of their parents' arms at the U.S.-Mexico border is not solely an immigration issue. Though child welfare services say their priority is to keep families intact, removing a child from the home is often a response to allegations or fear of potential abuse. A recent report from the Department of Health and Human Services says foster care placements have increased by 10% nationally, and in some states, they've seen a drastic increase in new foster care cases. The report looks at the lack of effort of child welfare systems across the country and what they've made to keep families together, and the scarcity of services that parents can access. So joining us to discuss those issues is Joanna Woolman, an associate law professor and director of the Institute for Children, Families, and Communities at the Mitchell Hamline School of Law, and Susan Sellers, the executive director of Families Organizing for Child Welfare and a parent advocate. Suzanne and Joanna, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
All right, ladies, Joanne, I want to start with you first. What does your work at as the executive director of the Institute for Children, Families, and Communities entail?
Our institute works to address child protection system issues through policy research, training, and teaching. We directly represent parents in child protection cases here through an interdisciplinary law clinic, and we also provide training to a wide variety of system stakeholders in Minnesota and nationally.
Has there been, in your experience, an overall national increase, or there has been an overall national increase in the foster care, children going into the foster care system, but from your experience, what are the reasons why these kids are ending up in the foster care system?
Well, most children come into the system due to neglect and not abuse, and neglect can include a whole variety of things. Two common forms of neglect in the system are drug addiction and persistent mental health issues that parents may be struggling with. So those are two common reasons that children end up in foster care.
And what is the relationship, at least between drug abuse and the child welfare system?
People who are addicted to drugs, children often come into the system. I mean, we saw this in the 1980s, and we're seeing it now with the opioid epidemic. I think it's important to remember that it's not automatic, right? I mean, if you use drugs, your kids shouldn't come into the system. But certainly, people who are drug addicts have many other problems and issues, and they often result in their children being removed from their home.
So when the state decides to come in and remove a child from the home, what is it that's being assessed? Is it just an assumption? Is it a fear? Is it an accusation? What is usually the underlying reason?
So, I mean, there's, you know, sort of what the law says federally and in most states, and then there's maybe the practice that's actually happening. So we should be assessing child safety, and most standards in most states require that children are only allowed to be removed from the home or should be removed from the home when they are in immediate danger or some similar standard to that. There's also a requirement that state child welfare agencies must use reasonable efforts to prevent the removal. So the law really says that foster care and removing children into foster care should be a last resort and not a go-to policy. They're assessing child safety, child well-being.
So what do those reasonable efforts look like?
Well, you know, from my experience, there are often not efforts to prevent the removal of children from the home. And that, I think, really goes to the question of sort of what access to services from a community perspective family and children have. So some of the efforts may be working with families to help get them into services before removal is necessary. But, I mean, as a lawyer representing clients, sometimes it's hard for me to understand what those efforts were.
Well, from your perspective, what are some of the intervention options for families before children are removed from the home? For example, is there something that a parent can preemptively do, or once the state gets involved, is it just, I don't want to say a lost cause, but is it a done deal?
No, I mean, I think that reasonable efforts would certainly involve working with the family. It's important to understand that in cases where there's been, like, serious physical abuse, you know, those are pretty clear-cut cases. In cases of neglect, like drug abuse, there's a whole variety of things that agencies could be doing with families. They could be helping families, you know, deal with stable housing. They could be helping with meaningful treatment programs, meaningful parenting skills, family therapy. Often tackling mental health issues is a problem, and there's so few resources in most communities communities to get meaningful mental health services. So all these kinds of preventative sort of public health services, I think, would really go a long way in preventing the removal of a lot of children.
All right, Suzanne, I want to bring you into the conversation and ask, what is your experience with the child welfare system?
Thank you. In the mid-90s, in the early and the mid-90s, I suffered from substance addiction. I was addicted to cocaine and alcohol at the time, and a call was made in 94. I only had a daughter at that time. She was small. And a call was made to the DCFS hotline in Illinois, where I live, alleging that I was neglecting my daughter by taking her to the homes of family members when I would go out on drug binges. I lost custody of her, and during that time, I got pregnant with my son, and I used drugs while my son, while being pregnant with my son. When I gave birth to my son, I was in labor at the hospital for 2 days prior to giving birth, and my urine was tested without my knowledge or consent while I was in labor. The hospital staff wouldn't allow me to get out of bed. They asked to bring me bedpans and asked that I urinate in the bedpans so as not to hurt myself. But little did I know that the reason for them asking me to do that was so that they can test my urine without my knowledge or consent. And custody of my son was removed from me immediately at birth.
So, Joanna, I want to bring you back. First of all, does any of this sound indicative of some of the cases that you've seen? And is there a correlation between the growing opioid abuse that we've seen around the country and this spike in children ending up in foster care?
Certainly, this situation is very common. I think that removing children who are born testing positive for drugs is a very common scenario for children coming into the system. You know, I think it's hard to say exactly what's going on with the spike in removals across the country. I certainly do think the opioid epidemic is playing a part of that. I also think the reasons are complex, and there may be many others. But certainly in Minnesota, we have seen an uptick in cases, in particular in northern Minnesota, of newborns. And so the opioid epidemic is impacting our removals here in Minnesota.
Well, Suzanne, tell me, after the birth of your son, did you know what the laws were for toxicology tests for pregnant mothers or for infants?
At the time, I do believe that at the time of the birth of my son, that it was not the law for hospitals to test for drugs and alcohol to test without knowledge and consent, and the patient's knowledge or consent. And I was not aware that they were not only testing, but I was not aware that I could lose custody of my son having tested positive for drugs and alcohol.
Well, so much of when we talk about child welfare and removing a child from the home, there's the question of the legality. And what is necessarily legal versus what's in the best interest? I don't want to say what's in the best interest of the child, but when your son was taken away from you, if the testing wasn't necessarily, if that was violating any rights of yours, then would it have been legal for your son to have been removed from your care?
Yeah, it was not legal. It is my belief that it was not legal for them to remove my son from my care if the testing was violating my rights.
Well, also, when we focus so much on the children, I'm just wondering from your experience as the parent, what was it like leaving a hospital after having just given birth without your baby?
There is the pain that I felt I cannot describe. To walk into a hospital with a baby inside of your stomach and to leave that hospital without a baby in your arms is devastating. I was sad. I was angry. I was confused. And I felt violated. I felt extremely violated having again, my urine tested for drugs without my knowledge or consent, and having my child removed from me. Even me, when I asked to hold my child at the hospital, when my child was in the nursery, I was allowed a visit to the nursery to hold my child and talk to my child with an armed guard standing over me with his gun drawn while I was sitting there trying to nurse and mother my son in those few minutes. That was terrifying, and still affects me to this day.
And, of course, Suzanne and Joanna, you can definitely jump in on this, but is there any indication of what the trauma is on parents when a child is removed?
Yes, there's a lot of research on that, and I certainly think this is one of the ways that the attention that's been brought regarding the border separations is helpful to our discussion about the trauma that children in the foster care system experience. So there's really lots of different kinds of trauma. There's short and long-term consequences to this, right? In the short term, children experience extreme ambivalent loss because their parents not dead, they're just gone. They're confused about their role in the family. They don't understand what's happening. They feel grief, guilt, anxiety, depression, shame. Some removals also involve a separation of siblings, which can be very catastrophic for relationships that have been close. The long-term consequences to removing children from their parents are also really significant, and we pay a huge cost as a society for those. Some of the long-term outcomes for children in foster care include more contact with the criminal justice system, teenage pregnancy, a risk for drug addiction or mental health issues. You know, we also think about adverse childhood experiences and the sort of long-term impact on just health in general to going through that as a child.
Do you know if there's any sort of mechanisms in place to help a parent, once they've lost custody of their child, navigate the system to reestablish contact or perhaps get custody back?
You mean in child protection cases?
Yeah.
Well, there are some states that have sort of innovative programs. Our state uses parent mentors, and we work with an interdisciplinary model here in our program where we actually have social work interns working with all of our parents in the system. Generally, though, I think the resources are really limited, and often parents find themselves extremely alone, isolated, and confused about the process. And so there are pockets of places around the country that have supportive services in the form of parent mentors, and I know Suzanne could also speak to this, but I think those are few and far between.
Well, Suzanne, I wanted to get your personal take on what was it like to gain access to any of those services?
Those services were virtually non-existent during the time that my case was in the system. However, there, as Joanna mentioned, there are pockets of the country that do have parent partner programs, and my organization in Illinois, Families Organizing for Child Welfare Justice, I offer some parent advocacy and mentoring programs through my organization as well.
So, Suzanne, I wanted to turn back to your story about after you had lost custody of your daughter and then your infant son. Did that push you deeper into addiction, or did that jolt you out of it? What happened to you after you lost custody of both your children?
A little of both. I developed a determination to a desire to get off drugs on the day that I left that hospital without my son. However, because the services were not readily accessible, and because I was poor, I did not have access to the services that I needed. I leaned on the caseworker, the DCFS caseworker that I had at the time, and asked for services. I was one of those parents. I knew I had a drug problem. When I became involved with the child welfare system, I told the judge, I told the caseworkers, the social workers, yes, I have a problem and I want help. I want to stop using drugs. No one wants to be a drug addict. I'll just say that. And the services that I was offered were insufficient for my needs. I was first offered an outpatient program. I stopped going to that program when it became obvious to me that the other clients in the program were continuing to use drugs, and I was being triggered every time I would go to the outpatient meetings. The DCFS worker did refer me to a 28-day inpatient that was, again, not sufficient for my need. I needed longer-term treatment, and I would have liked to have had treatment where I was able to bring my children to the treatment facility with me. I found a longer-term treatment center myself by asking friends in the crack house, had they gone the treatment before, and could they tell me, point me in the right direction of where to go?
That is an unusual resource, but if it sounds like it's one that definitely got you to the place that you needed to go to eventually get sober, is that correct?
That is correct.
And how long have you been sober?
I have, in September next month, I will have been sober. I will be sober 21 years. I attended, when I asked the crack house friends about a treatment center, they told me where to go to sign up for a bed. I went and signed up for a bed in a 90-day treatment facility. I went to that facility September 22nd of 1997, and I've been sober since. After exiting that 90-day program, I went to a 2-year recovery home program. I began working, going to school, going to church, doing everything I needed to do to stabilize my life and to, in an attempt to regain custody of my children.
All right. Well, first of all, we definitely want to send out our congratulations. But Joanna, I want to ask, is there any indication as to why short-term treatment programs, because as we're listening to Suzanne talk, she's talking about 2 years and 3 months and longer spans of time. Is there a reason why short-term treatment programs are being offered to parents before the longer-term ones?
You know, I mean, certainly I think cost has got to be the main motivating factor there. It's certainly cheaper to send someone to a cheaper program. To a shorter program. That is the case in Minnesota. I think also there are many fewer, long-term, comprehensive, meaningful treatment programs, in particular for drugs like, opioids. And if their choice that an agency has is between no program, a short program, or the better long program, you know, a short program is going to be something they would consider, even though it may ultimately not be effective.
One of also the larger questions in all of this is what role that race and class is playing in this system. Suzanne mentioned that she was poor, and she believes that that was a big part of the reason why she didn't have access to the resources to fight losing custody. But how disproportionate is our people of color and poor people being treated in the child welfare system now?
Well, like our criminal justice system, the child welfare system in our country certainly punishes families of color and poor families much more often. Removal rates for African Americans and American Indians are extremely high in many states, Minnesota included. In Minnesota, for example, African American children are 5 times more likely to be removed, and American Indian children 10 times more likely. Where I practice here in Minnesota, I continue to be astonished by these disparities. Poor people also certainly get caught up in the child welfare system more than other classes, and the intersection of being poor, black, and a single mother is a common one in our current child welfare system.
And I also wanted to circle back. In several of your answers, you keep using the word meaningful, and I just wanted to get a broader understanding of what exactly you mean by meaningful, meaningful treatment, meaningful options.
Well, there's a requirement under the law that reasonable efforts are utilized by the agency to try to fix the problem that has led to an out-of-home placement. And trying to fix the problem means offering a service that's actually going to work. So when I say meaningful, I mean sending a parent to a service that has a chance of being successful, not sending someone who's addicted to opioids to a week-long treatment program, not sending someone who has comprehensive and myriad issues with drugs and mental health simply to see a therapist. We need to be sending people and developing and creating a system where people can actually get help for their problems. So that's what I mean when I say meaningful, something that might work.
All right. I want to bring up that in 1998, a study from the University of Florida found that children who were allowed to stay with mothers despite cocaine use during pregnancy did better on all of their developmental milestones than babies that were placed in foster care. So does research like this impact policy at all?
I mean, clearly it should. I'm not sure that it does much at this point, certainly not in the way that it could be. You know, ways that it should be impacting policy are in as many cases as possible, we should be keeping children with parents in as many situations as we can. And that's going to be utilizing creative solutions like other family members, utilizing community support, family-inclusive treatment and service providers where children and parents can receive treatment together and the child can stay in the home. These programs are so infrequently used and offered, at least in my experience in Minnesota. I also think our current policies really show a staggering lack of awareness around the issue of addiction in general. It's a disease. So taking a punitive approach to drug addiction certainly isn't the way, I think, to approach this problem.
Suzanne, that actually sounds sort of like some of the things that you were hoping for in your own situation, a situation where you could have your children with you as you sought treatment. But I want to fast forward, I guess, several years to when you were finally able to get reunited with your daughter.
Yes, I've been reunited with both of my children. We reunited on our own volition after they both turned 18 years of age. My parental rights were terminated in 1999. I was coerced into signing over my rights to a family member. I signed an irrevocable parental rights document because of being coerced by the caseworker. At the time, it was a private agency. DCFS had transferred my case to a private agency that I won't name at this point. And I was told by the caseworker at that agency that if I didn't sign over my, even though I was 2 years and 2 months sober at the time, if I didn't sign over my rights, my children would go on a global database and be adopted overseas, and I would never see them again. And in addition, I would have a criminal record, and I would never be able to hold a job. And that scared me, among some other things that other players in the situation were saying. And I signed over the document. I will go to my grave regretting that I signed that document. I will regret that for the rest of my life. But the biggest thing is, my biggest thing is, why did my case get to the termination of parental rights stage? When I did admit that I had an addiction, I had a disease, I wanted help with it, I wasn't given the sufficient help that was needed to rectify my situation. And then even after I did rectify it on my own, through my own means and research, I still was not given an opportunity to reunite with my family. My children sought me out, sought a relationship with me when they each turned 18, which was in the year 2011 and 2013, respectively.
And Joanne, is there any indication that the system, once a child is removed from a parent, gives any thought to this eventual reunification, that this child might want to eventually come to know who their parent is, even if that parent was struggling when they were born or very young?
Yeah, I mean, certainly my experience, and I think the experience in most places, would indicate that children want to be with their families, and it's a rare case where a child does not want to be returned home. You know, one of the problems, I think, in our system is that we're really geared up and we plan for the removal, and we automatically go to removing children, and then once we've done that, we're not very good at figuring out how to successfully get them back. We need to think about the kinds of services during the time that they're removed, if that becomes necessary, to really make the reunification a success. But in the longer term, I mean, there's all kinds of legislation around the country. Here we're working on a bill in Minnesota to allow parents to petition for their parental rights back if their children are still, you know, up for adoption. So that probably wouldn't have applied in Suzanne's case, but there is a movement to allow for the sort of reestablishment of parental rights, which I think is a really good policy.
But what are your thoughts or concerns about the fact that even with this data, we still are seeing stricter laws, tougher laws showing up in Kentucky and Arizona?
I think we're definitely moving in the wrong direction. I think that what we understand about child separation is that it causes short and long-term trauma that is really awful for children and families, and that our policies should be reflecting a more strength-based system with the aim of building up families and communities and providing lasting resources and support so that people, families, children can thrive. So the laws that have just been passed in Arizona and Kentucky, which allow states to move immediately to terminate parental rights in cases of newborns exposed to opioids in utero, are really harmful to families. I don't think they make sense in the context of what we know about brain science of children, but also the disease of addiction. They're very concerning from my perspective.
What role do social workers and administrators play in the foster care system in navigating all of this?
I mean, administrators and social workers are making decisions every day about whether or not to remove children or whether or not to remove or to return children home, whether or not to file petitions to terminate parental rights. They have a huge amount of power in the system and are making decisions that forever impact families.
Based on policy, is that what they're making the decisions on, or is it more on a gut feeling or a concern from them on their own?
You know, I think most most agencies follow the law, and the law is pretty clear about what needs to happen. I think there's a lot of issues that agencies and administrators are dealing with. Number one, just not enough funding, right? There's huge budgetary constraints on being able to provide the kind of work that we need to help people in the system. I think there's burnout. I think caseworkers have an extremely challenging job, and if there's not enough of them, they're not able to do their job, and that harms everyone.
Suzanne, we're almost running out of time, but I did want to ask you about what the Families Organizing for Child Welfare, your organization, what it does and what you're doing right now as a parent advocate, given your life experience.
Thank you. I was a volunteer parent advocate with a local not-for-profit in the Chicago area for 10 or 11 years before starting my own organization, Families Organizing for Child Welfare Justice, in the year 2015. We provide mentoring and parent advocacy services to parents. Because my organization is fledgling, I'm not receiving any real donations from the public or any grants. I'm unable to provide those services to parents in the widespread manner that I'd like. I'm encouraged by the recent passing of the Family First Prevention Services Act of 2018, which provides states with 12 months of funding for families to receive services, not just a child and not just after a child has been placed in the system, but in an effort to prevent families from becoming involved with the child welfare system in the first place. We just need more states to opt in to receiving the funding under that new act, which begins in October 2019. I'm also encouraged by the work being done by various committees and organizations in the country. I'm a member of the Casey Family Programs Birth Parent Advisory Committee, and Casey is headquartered here in Seattle, Washington.
Okay, Suzanne.
We work as a group, as a collective, to advise lawmakers and policymakers.
Suzanne, we're going to have to leave it there. I'm sorry, but we are running out of time. I want to thank you both so much for joining me today. I'm Jenna Flanagan, and I've been speaking with attorney Joanna Wollman, the director of the Child Protection Program at the Mitchell Hamline School of Law, and Suzanne Sellers, the executive director of Families Organizing for Child Welfare Justice.